But you've gotten away from the mustache. Because you had a different...
Because Moz is profitable again.
Oh. Wait, what?
So you only didn't read the book.
No, I did. I am in the process of reading it.
So, yeah, I think there's a section called Don't Bet Your Facial Hair on Your Company Performance.
I missed that part.
Yeah.
Okay. How to get an investor to pay attention, how to find top software engineers, and yes, even how to game Hacker News. Those are some of the secrets that entrepreneur Rand Fishkin has learned as a startup founder, and he shares those and bigger insights in his new book, Lost and Founder, A Painfully Honest Guide to the Startup World. Rand, it's great to have you here.
Todd, thank you so much for having me.
And joining me here is John Cook.
Hello, everybody.
So for those of you who don't know Rand, he is the co-founder and former CEO of Seattle technology company Moz. He has a new company called SparkToro. Am I pronouncing that right?
Absolutely.
And we're going to talk a little bit about that later on. His new book, Lost and Founder, comes out on April 24th. So that is the setup. How do you want to jump in?
Why'd you write this book?
Well, I made
There's a lot of painfully honest excerpts in here, Rand. So why did you want to bare your soul?
That subtitle is not kidding around.
Yeah, it's not.
We did have another subtitle. My editor and I had another subtitle that we almost went with that was the mostly awful, sometimes awesome truth about starting a company. But I think
I like both of them, actually. Yeah, I like the title, too.
I think this one, yeah. I think this works. Oh, so Lost and Founder comes from Geraldine, my wife.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Who you guys know.
Yeah.
So I wrote this because as a founder, I made a lot of dumb mistakes that was... Most of them were biased by my understanding of what startup founders are supposed to do, right? What venture capital culture, what Silicon Valley startup culture, what startup media culture, frankly, amplifies about how a startup founder is supposed to behave and what a company is supposed to do and look like. And it was painful. Like, it sucked. It went off the rails in a number of ways. And granted, Moz has managed to become, you know, a $47, $50 million a year company and employs lots of people, has lots of customers. So it survived and grown, and that's great. But I wrote this book so that hopefully the mistakes that other founders and early stage teams make don't have to be exactly the same ones that I made.
So what are, I know there are many of them, but what are the top two, three, four lessons or the things that you think people will take away from the book or just from your own personal experience, those painful moments that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, I think some of the ones that have seemed to resonate most with folks who've read the book early on are biasing against MVPs. I think that was sort of sacrilegious to not do.
So unpack that for us, because most people think baseball, but you're actually talking about minimum viable products. So explain what that means for people who may not know.
Thankfully, your audience will not think baseball.
You'd be surprised.
I might be surprised. That's fair. maybe if the Mariners have a winning season,
yes,
the audience.
So you're biased against minimum viable products. So the notion of just getting something out there.
And that was another part that I just looking at the book, there was a part that kind of ties into that, kind of a bias against pivots as well. Because they're kind of tied together, those two, I would say.
In a way, yeah. Yeah. In a way.
Yeah, so explain this.
Sure. So Eric Ries wrote this wonderful book that is very awesome for very early stage companies called The Lean Startup, right? And he describes this process where you build a product that is barely useful and usable, but it solves this important pain point and it validates whether there's actually a market for the thing you're building. And it helps you know early on without investing, you know, millions of dollars of cash in a huge team, whether you're onto something, whether your idea has got the potential for traction.
Yeah, get it out there early.
Get it out there early. And this is a very smart idea if you are, you know, two founders in a garage and you're trying to validate that, like, oh yes, people really do need this problem solved and they're willing to pay, even if we provide a fairly crummy experience around it. But the problem is that the MVP has become religiously observed in all forms of the startup and tech world at all sizes and shapes. And that is just straight up dumb. So let me explain to you. Or give you an example. Sorry, not explain. Let's say that we are Tesla. We're at Tesla in, I don't know, 2005. And we're about to come out with the very first car that the company makes. And we decide, you know what? I think we can slide by with an MVP here.
That probably is not smart.
Well, there's a bunch of reasons why, right? And we all instinctively know that. And yet, why do so many companies think that's an okay idea?
I think because the flip side of the MVP is what happened at Microsoft back in the day, and Todd, you can speak to this more, about things getting tied up in a bureaucracy and going through so many processes and teams and testing that they miss market opportunities because they're so slow getting it out there. I mean, that's the flip side of it.
So where do you draw the line?
Yeah,
totally agree. I think that this is a really interesting and should be a constant push and pull challenge. And I think I worry that the pendulum has swung too far to minimum and too far away from viable. And many, many companies that could be awesome instead release products that are just subpar. They're not good enough. And then companies like Moz, right, who become relatively large in their space, they release MVPs. And the philosophy behind it is reasonable, right? The philosophy is like, hey, we're putting out this new tool. It's not great yet, but it solves this pain point. And 6 months from now, a year from now, 2 years from now, it's going to be even better. No one pays attention to that. No one cares. They go, is this better than what anything else I can get in the market right now? No, not interested. And Moz's reputation
tarnishes the brand.
That's exactly right. It tarnishes the brand reputation.
So that's a really good lesson, the bias against MVPs, and at least understanding the implications of the minimum viable product. Another thing that really struck me about the book was your bias toward transparency. And there's some great stories in the book. And this gets into one of your defining characteristics as a person and as a leader.
Yeah, which I want to dig into. Yeah.
So one of the stories you tell is about the debt collector who tracked you down in the early days of what was then SEO Moz, right? You and your mom, Jillian, had started the company together, and she actually kept the fact that it was struggling away from your dad, and you did by extension, which then caused or contributed to a huge family rift that continues to this day.
Yeah, no, it's, I think the official term is shit show.
So what did you take away from that? Because it clearly, you talking about a pendulum, I mean, it swung totally the other way. I mean, you are radically transparent about your company, your life. Yeah. So tell us how that.
Well, I think that a lot of people, when you ask and you dig into why someone has a core value, something that they are unwilling to violate in their practices, in their life, in their business, in how they spend money, whatever it is, you can almost always trace that back to either they were taught and trained to do something, right? It was sort of inherent in them, brought to them by their religion or their parents, their family, whatever. Or it's a reaction to that. And so in my case, it's really clearly a reaction, right? It's a reaction to this world of secrecy and of lies and of lies of omission mostly, and the pain that accompanied those lies was so hard for me to handle that I just went the complete other direction and said, you know what? What if I was completely transparent and totally vulnerable all the time, and I will take all the sticks and stones that brings? Compared to the pain of the lies, it's nothing to me. And so I think that's where that comes from.
Has there ever been a time when you've regretted that?
There have definitely been times when it has been a non-optimal outcome, even a terrible outcome. So one of my favorite memories around this, and this is probably actually in a way a good thing, but I think a lot of founders will identify with it, is I had a call once with an investor. I think I can say who they are now.
Well,
what are they going to do?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay, I want to say the name, but I can't remember who it is.
I'll come up with it.
It wasn't Matrix Partners. It wasn't Bessemer.
Benchmark.
It wasn't Benchmark. They were actually pretty good. Benchmark was pretty good with me, actually. I wish I could remember. I'm sorry.
It was obviously Brad Feld.
It was not Brad Feld. So it
was
an investor.
Greg Gottesman, not Madrona.
It wasn't Madrona. It was someone in Silicon Valley. But in any case, I had a call with this guy. He had come up to Seattle. He'd visited Moz's offices. You know, we really liked him. He liked the company. He was on the verge of investing, but we ended up choosing another investor who then pulled out of our deal. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember this blog post.
Yeah.
I remember the transparency of it and saying, what in the world is Rand doing?
Yeah, what is he doing?
Because the guy flipped as he
told basically the story of how everything fell apart.
He's going to destroy his ability to raise capital ever again. I'm sure you heard this.
And that is exact. So I had this call with this guy, and he basically said,
I remember the blog post. I thought you were going to tell this story. Yeah.
So the blog post came out, right? The blog post described the failed fundraising process. And this guy, who wasn't part of that, right? He'd been someone I'd pitched, but he was not negative. You know, nothing was negatively cast on him. He basically said, I'm not interested in chatting with you or Moz again, and I better not read about this on your blog. Like, I better not read about this conversation that you were at. Now he's going to hear about it on a podcast, but you know.
Yeah.
But you forgot who he is, so you're safe.
That's the thing. He must not have been that memorable.
There you go.
He is like generic VC white dude. I can't.
But this transparency extended to your recent exit for Moz. John and I were actually...
I don't know, you tell us from the outside.
It appeared to be. So you wrote in the post announcing your exit from Moz, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 0 is, quote, fired and escorted out of the building by security, and 10 is, quote, left entirely of his own accord on wonderful terms, my departure is around a 4. And you said you were leaving with a bit of a chip on your shoulder. No, I see what you're meaning. That is not completely transparent because you didn't say what led to the 4.
I mean, it infuriates me that that's what I have to write and not here's what happened and why it happened. And
oh, so could you tell us now?
I can't. I mean,
you could.
Let's see, I could.
But there would be repercussions.
But there'd be repercussions legal, and a bunch perhaps? Of people I promised that I wouldn't.
Okay.
Are there legal ones? Maybe there are. Maybe
but why even write that? I mean, because you
because that's as far as I can go. Right. And I will always go as far as I can go. So,
but you're still involved in Moz.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
You're still a shareholder.
Still
and,
cheering for that company to succeed.
Yeah. So I guess by putting out even a message like that, do you feel it could harm the company or harm what they're trying to accomplish?
So
because
I'll
tell you that when Todd and I read it, the impression was along the lines of what happened? You know,
you kind of
teed this up for a lot of curiosity of something going on there that was intriguing.
Well, so let's see. I can take away a little bit of the intrigue by saying that I'm on wonderful terms with, you know, tons of the folks there, cheering for them and love them, but had a lot of conflict with the current CEO, Sarah Burt. So that I think it was professional conflict that bled into personal conflict that bled into more professional conflict.
Let's unpack that just a little bit because like you and Sarah were tied at the hip for a while and you had – I mean she was kind of handpicked to lead the company and it seemed like you guys were –
No, John, I can't tell you how heartbreaking it is. We babysat her son all the time. I changed his diapers. We went on vacations together. She was the officiant at Geraldine and I's wedding. This was not just a heartbreaking professional loss. Like it was a heartbreaking personal loss. As deep a loss as I have had with my family members too.
And when you're at an early stage startup, I mean, it is family. I mean, when you've built something from a few employees to something bigger. I mean, you still have that family
hopefully less
feel.
Dysfunctional than most American families, but sure, yes.
Is that one of the reasons why you felt you had to write the book was to talk about that experience and what that's like?
Well, so the experience of me leaving is not really in the book because the book was wrapped up before that whole series of events kicked off. So you won't find that in there. I think there's maybe one line in the epilogue about it or the afterword, but... no, I think when you ask why be so transparent about that, my answer is that about these very hard, painful, non-optimal things that might harm your marketing or your market perception. My answer to that is I don't think transparency is a tactic. I think it's a value. And a value means that you are willing to sacrifice positive business outcomes in exchange for adhering to the value. So if you say, we value kindness here, or we value productivity here, right? It means you're willing to trade off things that could be more optimal for the business in exchange for living up to that value. So Delta Airlines CEO, right? What was that, 6 weeks ago or something after the shootings in Florida, the Senate and the governor of Atlanta, Georgia,
yeah.
Georgia that right. they're in, right?
Yep.
Basically said, if you don't reforge your relationship with the NRA and give NRA members the discount that they used to get on Delta, we will, you know, basically revoke this funding that gives Delta $50 million a year to stay here in Georgia. And the Delta CEO did a press release that said, our values are not for sale. Go F yourself. And I went, I think maybe I should put Delta on my list of companies I'm going to fly with, right? Because that I think that displays actual values as opposed to, hey, let's get in a room and do a little backdoor deal and maybe we can do something that saves face for everybody. I don't know. I find those kinds of values very compelling. I think that's a much better reason to build a startup, to build a company than I want to make a lot of money.
That is Rand Fishkin, the co-founder and longtime CEO of Moz and the author of Lost and Founder, a new book coming out on April 24th. Before we take a break, I wanted to add that we reached out to current Moz CEO, Sarah Bird, after our conversation and offered her a chance to respond to Rand's comments about his departure from the company. Here's what she had to say. Quote, I'm very grateful to Rand for his leadership over the years. I wouldn't be where I am now without him. He's changed my life for the better, and I know he has done the same for thousands of others. I wish him the best with SparkToro. We're all rooting for him. That was a quote from Sarah Bird, the current CEO of Moz. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more from Rand Fishkin on the lessons he's picked up as an entrepreneur.
This GeekWire podcast is sponsored in part by Fred Hutch Obliteride, a fundraising bike ride and 5K walk to raise millions of dollars with the goal of curing cancer faster. Scenic routes for all levels of riders include 25-mile, 50-mile, and 100-mile rides, plus a 5K walk. Be a superhero and invest in Fred Hutch scientists to end cancer once and for all. Obliteride takes place August 11th. Registration and info at obliteride.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop.
And John Cook.
We're talking this week with Rand Fishkin. He is a longtime Seattle-based entrepreneur and the author of a new book called Lost and Founder, a painfully honest field guide to the startup world. Rand, we were just talking about your exit from Moz. Is there anything you want to say more on that topic that would wrap it up or make you, you know, feel even more transparent or better about that?
Sure. More transparent. I mean, I think I've about gone to my limit on that front. I will say that, you know, as sad as I am to be leaving and as frustrating as the circumstances might be, I am kind of excited to get to do something new. I think that lots of founders find over time that they love a certain size of company and structure of company. And I love small. I love small and nimble and a team where everybody knows each other. And so I think maybe in that way, you know, SparkToro is going to be really fun.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. This is your new company, SparkToro. You're obviously in a very early stage, but you're in marketing again. And we should point out, Moz was about inbound marketing. It was originally search engine optimization.
Yeah, SEO, that's right.
But the idea was, hey, you want to make your website as optimized as possible for this world of Google. And you really rode the wave of Google, as you write in the book. If you look at how Moz has evolved, it's gotten into things like social and other inbound marketing, as they call it. What does SparkToro do, or what will you do in contrast?
Yeah, so I think this is actually a hugely interesting lesson that I learned at Moz and did write about in here. So you'll remember that a few years ago, you know, Moz tried to get into all these other different practices around inbound marketing, and then basically did a big round of layoffs and pulled back and went back to just doing SEO software. And I think that is it is really hard to be known for doing many, many things well. And it's much easier to be really well known for doing one thing well and having that one association. I think this is another way that human beings sort of associate things with brands, right? They think of GeekWire. I think of, oh yeah, the Seattle tech world, GeekWire. They cover Seattle and tech. Would it be impossible for GeekWire to go to San Diego or Portland or Boise? No, not impossible. But I bet it would take years before people, when they heard the name GeekWire, would think of not Seattle Tech World, right? And that's a challenge, but it's also a superpower. Because I don't think of anything else when somebody says, oh, who covers the Seattle Tech World? It's one name, right? And that's a powerful thing. So SparkToro, again, trying to be extremely, extremely focused and specifically on this one problem, which is when you are a marketer or an early stage founder and you're trying to reach a specific audience. So, you know, let's say the three of us, four of us decide to build a company that does lighting design and we're going to sell to interior decorators. I don't know anything about the world of interior decorators. I don't know where they hang out. I don't know what events they go to. I don't know if they listen to podcasts or which ones. I have no idea who they follow on Twitter or what blogs they read or where I could find them on the internet or in the real world. And that is a painful problem that often takes weeks or months of marketers' work just to generate like an Excel spreadsheet of, okay, here's where these people hang out. And that's what I want to try and help solve with SparkToro. So it's essentially, I'm calling it an influencer and audience intelligence platform. We will see. I think that process of finding where your audience hangs out is a problem that deserves a solution.
In the digital world, where they hang out in the digital world? Well, or the physical too?
Both.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah, both.
So you already mentioned one lesson you took away from Moz was maybe spreading yourself too thin into areas that you shouldn't have gotten into. Are there any other lessons as you're starting the new startup up that you can share with us?
Yeah. I mean, focus is a big one. The MVP versus EVP thing is another huge one. I also think one of the mistakes that I made that many, many companies make is around hiring. And specifically, I showed off this kind of matrix view in the book, but the idea is that if you think of a person who could potentially join your team as being, you know, extraordinary and remarkable along two sort of independent vectors. One is their fit with your team's culture, right? They share your values, share your vision, believe all have the same answers to the questions like, here's why we should fire these kinds of people and hire these kinds of people. And here's the behavior we should reward versus we should not put up with at all. Those kinds of, you know, values and culture questions. And then there's performance, right? Like the quality and quantity of output that the person actually does if they're a marketer or designer or developer or whatever they do. Along those two vectors, most companies will sacrifice fit with the culture for fit with competence.
So performance reigns over culture fit. Is
it
that
does.
What you're saying? And a lot of companies. And it shouldn't.
And a lot of companies. Here's specifically why it shouldn't. One is that, well, there's two huge reasons. One is that it turns out when people work in teams, the performance of the team is best correlated with the degree to which everyone on the team feels psychologically safe and trusted in the environment, which is, in my opinion, that's kind of insane. When I learned this, right, because Google did this big experiment and series of research posts, I think it was called Project Aristotle that they did over at Google, and they looked at, you know, what correlates with the teams that perform the best. And it wasn't the people who had the best engineers on them or even the best managers. It wasn't the people who had the most technical competence or, you know, got the best grades or were the employees who, you know, had the best fit when they came in. It was people who felt the safest and best with their team. Right? They loved being around each other. They trusted each other. Crazy? A little bit.
That makes sense. I mean, there's a team dynamic that if somebody's feeling down, the other person's going to pull them up and all work together and row in the same direction.
But there has to be a base level of competence, right?
So I'm assuming most teams at Google
that's right.
have a base level of competence.
Right.
But that's the insane part is that you could take some of the worst technical teams at Google and if they felt this way, they would still outperform geniuses who are assholes.
So how do you measure for this when you're hiring? How do you try to get the people on the, you know, you have your cultural values
and you can
measure against that. But are there tricks or tools that you can use to make sure you get somebody who's truly embodying those values?
Yes, I think there absolutely are. But the more important bit than how do you hire for them is who you keep and who you let go. I think that actually will determine who you retain on your team. And it's more important to show to everybody on the team that this is how you will behave rather than to be perfect about bringing only the best culture fits onto the team. If you're good at letting people go who are wrong fits quickly, no problem. In some ways, it's almost good for you to get a few of those so that you prove to the team, no, this person may have seemed like a, you know, whatever the euphemism is, a ninja rock star or whatever. But in fact, their performance was subpar, or their culture fit was subpar, even if their performance.
Or it could be both.
Yeah, or it could be both. Yeah. The other big reason that this is so important is because of fungibility of these skills. So someone who's a great culture fit can improve their performance. That is in fact, that's pretty much the whole human experience. We improve our performance. I'm slightly smarter this week than I was last week, hopefully, right? If I chop wood for 6 weeks, I'll probably know how to actually chop wood. I don't know how right now. But the ability to improve your culture match, your culture fit, your belief in the values, that is way harder. Not impossible, but way, way harder. And so if you bias to keeping those people who are amazing fits on the culture side and improving their skills in a couple years, or maybe even just a few months, you'll have someone absolutely remarkable on your team versus the other way where, and I'm sure we've all seen this in our professional careers, right? That person who's like constantly pissing off everyone that they work with and the manager's like, yeah, I'll talk to them again. I'll work with them. I'll try and get them there. And they never do versus like, you know, the junior help team person who became a software engineer and who's now really great at their job.
So what about investing and how you're approaching the funding of your new company? Because, and I should point out, we did a Rand whiteboard Friday for GeekWire, and it's a video that we'll be posting in the spirit of the whiteboard Fridays that you do for Moz. Yeah. And you talked specifically about investors and what they're looking for versus what's healthy for the company. Explain that and explain how that's going to inform your funding of your new company, SparkToro.
Yeah, sure. So I think actually investors as a whole are pretty darn good about this, but founders as a whole are horrible about listening to them. What you'll hear, and you guys hear this all the time, is venture capital is wrong for 99% of companies. And yet 99% of founders I know think it's right for them. Something is messed up there, right? And I think that the big part that's messed up is the belief and amplification of the idea that venture capital sits at the pinnacle of the startup and tech world experience. That is everybody else is building a lifestyle company or a nice to have kind of a company. But venture-backed entrepreneurs are building the real companies, right? The ones that are world-changing, the ones that apparently we all worship and should view with reverence and should all aspire to be. And that sounds like mass insanity to me.
Well, that is what the venture capitalists want. They want those groundbreaking, world-changing companies, and they may be 1%, but they'll go for 100. You know, they'll invest in 100 to get that one.
Yeah, yeah. And the model
and
is
all
99
the entrepreneurs will. The other 99 entrepreneurs will think they're going to be that one.
Yeah.
So that is the challenge. I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think it is important for most entrepreneurs to understand it's not for them and to make the conscious choice not to go that route.
And I think
Todd and I did that essentially. I mean,
we
took a small angel round right off the bat, but have eschewed venture capital from the very beginning.
And I think brilliantly so.
Well, thank you.
Here's the crazy part. Well, but look at how long GeekWire survived. Look at the brand that it's built. Look how it's fended off any competitor or potential competitor in the space, right? Like I don't think you could look at GeekWire's mission to become, you know, the source for, you know, the Seattle tech world and say it's done anything but phenomenally, right?
Oh, sure you could.
Yeah. Well,
anyway, that's a whole other podcast.
Internally, you probably can't. Yeah. Externally, it's hard for anybody else to do because they can't point to someone else and say, oh, well, they did it better because no one's done it better.
So you're out in pursuit of a $50 million venture round.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Next unicorn startup.
SpaceX this thing.
Are you you're bootstrapping, I assume?
Yeah. No, actually.
Okay.
I'm not. I am planning to raise an angel round similar to you guys, but in a unique sort of format. So, not a C corp, not doing stock and stock options, but rather an LLC that has the option to pay distributions as a way to pay back
Why
its
are you
investors.
Doing that?
A bunch of reasons. One, because I don't want to be forced into the binary outcome of you must sell in order to be successful. And two, because I also really love and it was inspired by 37 Signals. I think, was it Jeff Bezos's family office that made an investment into 37 Signals and then a few years ago said, that's actually been the best performing investment that we've ever made, that the office had ever made. Out of hundreds of startups that had exits, because they keep kicking off dividends to us. We keep getting paid. So they're successful and we're successful. What a beautiful model. I kind of love it. It's very non-traditional. Well, sorry. It's very traditional.
It's non-traditional in the tech world.
It's non-traditional certainly. In the tech world yeah. in the last 20 years. Yeah.
Do you think we'll see more companies following that path? Or do you think there's still this ethos of raising money and going for that big home run?
Right now, the big home run has this perception that has run away. But I hope that's going to change soon.
We are talking with Rand Fishkin. He is the author of Lost and Founder, coming out on April 24th. He's the co-founder and former CEO of Moz. And we will be right back with more on GeekWire. Welcome back to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook, and we are talking with Rand Fishkin, the author of Lost and Founder, a new book coming out on April 24th.
So when we just left, Rand, you were talking about the idea of starting SparkToro as an LLC so you could pay out dividends, not thinking with this maybe giant home run venture capital mentality. You know, one of the rubs in Seattle that I've heard from the entrepreneurial community is frankly that not enough people think with that kind of home run mentality, that they're thinking about more like bunt base hits or an easy single or double, not swinging enough for the fences here.
Yeah,
and that's been a rub.
Who talks about that?
Well, some people have been enormously successful, like Rich Barton, who is the co-founder of Zillow and Expedia. Others in the venture capital community that I've encountered who've just said that. And frankly, it's not just Rich. It's people that have had modest success. And there's been pressure on some companies because of the boards that are in place to take maybe the $25 million acquisition bite rather than build that company for the next 3 or 4 years. I mean,
I'll give you a good example. Yeah. Synosis Health. That was Shwetik Patel's latest company. They had some really interesting stuff they were doing with smartphones as medical diagnostic equipment. I mean, this thing looked like it could be Seattle's next big company. And,
well, it's pretty early stage still.
Right, but it's Shwetik Patel. He's sold companies to Belkin, and I can't remember. He's like, he's a MacArthur genius. And
yeah, this yeah, is done his, it a bunch
but
of
he's
times.
Had yeah. a lot of base hits, too.
I yeah.
mean, and I guess that is the thing.
And from what we understand,
Google ended up buying them, should say.
Yeah, they were acquired by Google very early. And from what we understand, there were people who were experienced entrepreneurs that were working with them, maybe on the board, and they wanted to keep going. And then some first-time entrepreneurs that were part of the team, they were very interested in selling.
And rightfully so. Right. So I think when you're a multi-time entrepreneur and you've got it made, you're in it for the glory. Right. But if you're a first-time entrepreneur and, you know, your mother-in-law could really, really use
a new roof,
$500,000 so that she can stay in a healthcare facility. Right. That's near your home instead of, you know, 100 miles away.
Right.
Take that goddamn money. Take that money. Like, don't.
But a lot of the people who've been very successful in business have turned down that money and continue to build for that, you know, have turned down acquisitions, have turned down additional venture money to build something even bigger.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that in some of those cases, they turned it down because the acquisition to them looked riskier than what they were playing with already. And in many, many cases, especially recently and especially in sort of the kind of hardcore tech world, I think that there's a bias to swing for the home run, don't take the base hit. I don't think that that's a bad thing.
No, I think that's good advice.
So wait, you don't think? I want to make sure I understand. Do you think taking the single?
Taking a single
or double is a bad thing.
Yeah. I don't think it's a bad thing. And I also think that because of this classic venture model where if your company
They're not even set up to take the single or double in the classic venture model. So they need a triple or home run, frankly.
They definitely do. But even entrepreneurs, right, who take venture capital, even if it's a very small amount, and now they're playing for, you know, that 10x, 20x return, those folks have no option to build a sustainable, profitable, long-growing business that can pay off dividends for a long period of time and make them wealthy, right? Their only options are, I sell now, or I pray to God that this market holds together and this company holds together and this team holds together and my venture capitalists hold together and I hold together in an emotionally and mentally stable state such that there'll be another opportunity for me to sell for even more down the road. So you have really boxed these folks in. You've railroaded them into your choice is 25 million or an even lower shot at 250. I'd take the 25, right?
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not taking the 25. I'm getting off the railroad. I don't want the tracks, right? I want to go out in the field and be able to play a bunch of different ways.
Rand, I want to throw one last curveball at you.
Please.
You, over the years, have been involved in a company that makes software for marketers, and now you're also involved in a different kind of marketing startup.
Yep.
You understand the value of data to marketers.
Todd, I think this was going to be my question. This is what I was going to ask, and I'm glad you're going there, I think.
What do you think about what's going on with Facebook?
Yes, this is what I was going to ask.
Is an online economy sustainable if it relies so heavily on generating personal data for marketers to capitalize on?
I wish it wasn't, but I don't think Americans actually care. I think the sad truth is that we don't give two craps about privacy. We only care about, wait, did you help my side win or lose an election? Oh, you did. Okay, then you're a bad guy, and so now I'm mad at you. And so because it fits conveniently into a current political narrative, it's in the news and the center of attention. Very frankly, if Hillary had won, I don't think anybody would be looking at it at all. I suspect we'd never even have heard of Cambridge Analytica. It just passed totally under the radar. I don't think Americans are ready or willing to care about their privacy. And I think we are very happy to trade a lot of privacy and private data for free, even if it actually ends up costing us a lot, because Facebook is very good at advertising to us and making us spend money through the sharing of that personal data.
If you could remake the online world from scratch, how would you do it?
Isn't this an episode of Silicon Valley?
Yeah.
Aren't they doing a new internet?
Or Black Mirror?
Yeah.
I am not nearly arrogant enough to think I have a good answer to that question. There's no way.
About just the future of marketing? I mean, what do you see in terms of did I let Rand wiggle off that one?
I was just going to say, whenever I think of that, I think of the famous Carl Sagan quote. I'm going to botch this, but I think it's, if you want to bake an apple pie from scratch, first you must invent the universe.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
Yes. So, I mean, that's kind of what it's kind of what you would have to do to recreate the internet at this point. I mean, at any rate, that's my.
There's small tweaks. If you want me to give you a few small tweaks.
Yeah, let's hear a few.
And maybe
small.
In the yeah.
Yeah, I mean I think it would be lovely and wonderful if some of the businesses that are currently advertising based were instead pay to play. Right? I love the model that, like, for example, Google's adopted with Drive, where, you know, you have all this free stuff and then you have more photos than this, why don't you pay us whatever it is, $10 a month or something.
Slack,
great, right? Wonderful types of things. I like that model a lot because I think that the finances actually create some transparency and some understanding. And so if it was $2 a month to use Facebook, but you didn't see ads, or if it was $5 or $6 a month to use Facebook and you got these other things from it, that could be really interesting because then it would be about serving users first rather than serving advertisers with the product. Users.
Facebook is as valuable to me in my life as Netflix is. And so I would equate the two in terms of monthly fee personally.
And it's pretty cool, right? It's pretty cool to see what a company that where you are the customer rather than the product can do for you. That'd be a change I'd love to see.
So, Rand, before we wrap up, I know the new book is all about advice for the startup world and entrepreneurs.
It's a cheat code, as
I
he
love
says.
The cheat code. Let's give people even a little bit more of a cheat code. If I were a 23-year-old entrepreneur coming out of the University of Washington and have this idea that I really want to go after, what's the first piece of advice that you give him or her?
I would spend some time in the startup world before I would jump in and create my own company. This is actually a big regret that I have, is that, you know, while the experience that my mom and I had is really interesting and fascinating.
And a great book.
Yeah.
Because you started, in your teens, 18?
Oh, in 1981, when I was 2 years old. My mom started this business that eventually became SEO Moms.
You weren't starting a startup yourself. You were basically starting building websites with your mom.
Right.
And then you kind of became co-founders together almost accidentally.
Exactly. And I guess what I wish, my regret is I wish I could have spent 3 or 4 years like at a few companies just to see what it's like. Because it's so hard to know how to execute and all these challenges that you'll face unless you've seen it somewhere else and you know what you like and don't like and you start to build a little bit of a network. I mean, you know, very frankly, like the network my mom and I had when we were doing Moz, it all came through the blog. There was nothing else. If I could have had, you know, a few people's shoulder to lean on in the professional world in those early years, I think that would have made a big difference. Because people who've been through this more than once, they can share those cheat codes with you. Right? Like they can tell you, oh, you're trying that? Yeah, we tried that. Give this a try instead. Right? That's huge.
Well, as your later self here, you had the opportunity to go join a startup or go join another company, but you did another startup yourself. So obviously you haven't learned, right?
John, I think this is why you make it a great...
Were you about to say, John, you a-hole? I think you were.
No. The total opposite. I hate when I'm listening to someone say something and I, as a listener, I can think of an obvious, like, hang on a minute, but you blah blah blah. And so please keep calling people on that, please.
But you are talking about your younger self versus older. Yeah, and you have learned a lot of lessons and you have a lot of battle scars, certainly.
Right. But now I have 17 years of experience in the space.
I guess it is a real question there, why you didn't go do something else. I mean, being a startup founder is hard. And you've learned that. You didn't have to go through this pain again. You could have gone to another company, you could have done something else. Why do this?
I have a lot to prove, very frankly. It's not the most emotionally healthy motivation in the world, but that's the real answer, right? Is that I feel like I have to prove that I can build a great, exciting company and that I don't have to follow this railroad path. That's a weird thing to say, but you know, there's a few people in this world who I want them to look and go, oh, damn, he is kind of good at this. Maybe we made a mistake. You know, like that. I want that to happen. I don't know if that'll actually happen. Even if I do build a great company, I don't know if that'll happen. But in my mind, that's why.
Well, this has been a great conversation, and the book is great and extremely helpful. It really is a cheat code, and I love that analogy to the video games where somebody says, "Do this, do that, and jump Mario over here. Why don't you?
Look, there's a chest behind that corner. Wait, what?"
Exactly. Rand Fishkin is a longtime Seattle entrepreneur and is running a new company called Spark Toro. We'll have much more on GeekWire, including Rand's special GeekWire Whiteboard Friday, where he talks about some of the lessons from his book, Lost and Founder, which is due out on April 24th. Rand, thanks very much for being here.
Guys, thank you so much for having me.
All right, until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
And I'm John Cook.
We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.
Thanks for listening to the GeekWire podcast. Follow all of our coverage of tech and science news at geekwire.com and subscribe to our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts.